Today we are going to hear an interview recorded a couple of years ago with distinguished scientist George Cowan. He was the founding president of the Santa Fe Institute. He worked on the Manhattan Project. He was also a founding member of the Los Alamos National Bank, and he was an early board member of the Santa Fe Opera. He died this year on the 20th of April. I'm very happy now to welcome Dr. George Cowan. He is a physical chemist who worked for 39 years at the Los Alamos National Laboratories. He served on the White House Council of Science Advisors and was the first president of the Santa Fe Institute. He's the author of the new memoir, Manhattan Project to the Santa Fe Institute, published by the University of New Mexico Press. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you for the introduction. Very kind.
Now, you grew up, as you write in your memoir, during Prohibition, which, as you said, made a lot of ordinary citizens into chemists. And you came from an immigrant family, had many interests, including literature and debating and all sorts of things. How did you decide to become a scientist?
I don't know that I ever decided to become a scientist. I believe that all babies are born scientists, and they grow out of it. And if they don't, then they remain scientists. But babies have to touch and feel and smell and taste and inquire into everything, and so they're 100% scientist.
You went to Princeton, and then you were in Los Alamos during the Manhattan Project. What was your role?
In Los Alamos?
In Los Alamos at the Manhattan
Project.
Because
the Manhattan Project is a big deal, and I was a member of the group that started that research at Princeton before it had a name, and while I was on that work, it got the name Manhattan Project when it became very large. How did I happen to do that? I was about to be drafted into, I'd just finished undergraduate work, and I was 1A on the draft list, which meant I had to report for service almost any day right now, and suddenly was deferred by the president and was expected to work on this very secret high-level thing, which was really going into high gear. I was at Princeton and doing things that they didn't have anybody else to do. For one thing, staying up three shifts a day and sleeping beside the cyclotron. So I was considered a valuable member of this team, and when we left Princeton, went to Chicago, I joined the Fermi group, so I had a very interesting experience there.
What was the actual kind of science that you did?
I was the man who knew a lot of chemistry and something about procuring the materials that we needed, where to go and how to get them, and so I was kind of the handyman, a clean-up man, and really enjoyed it. It was a great job.
Then you left Los Alamos, and then you came back in 1949, and you were part of a group that discovered that the Soviet Union had been testing nuclear weapons.
Well, yes. It was based on the fact that there was at that time, highly secret group of Air Force people who were filtering air samples, and they picked up debris from the first Russian bomb test. So that material came to our laboratory, and we had to guarantee from radiochemical measurements that this was indeed a fission bomb and not an accidental explosion, which would have had different ratios of fission products.
And what was the political reaction to that discovery?
Well, the president was Harry Truman, and I think he did not have a high opinion of scientists. He liked his advisors, and they were telling him that this was probably an explosion and not a weapon. There were many measurements that said it was an explosion, but he had to be persuaded. It took a while.
You write it several different times in the book about the gap between scientists and politicians, and that's a difficult, both political and intellectual gap to cross?
Well, politicians have to think in terms of getting elected, and very frequently, if they're congressmen, it's every 2 years, and at most, what is it, 6 years, a senator term. And so they have to do a lot of campaigning, and campaign arguments aren't necessarily scientific. It helps to give them something to put in the display window. And so talking to politicians means that you have to study their vocabulary, and they won't study ours.
Now, what was your role in the development of the thermonuclear bomb?
Radiochemists were used with fission weapon tests to measure fission products. There are a lot of them, and so they had a choice of diagnostic tests in fission weapons. In thermonuclear weapons, the products are largely hydrogen and helium, and you can't measure them. They're too common in the atmosphere. So we had to add detectors, which were activated by the bomb itself, and then draw conclusions about the performance of the weapons from detector analysis. And that was a whole new thing. We had to start from scratch, work it out. And that's what we did. There was a lot of new stuff and experimentation, but it seemed to work.
It was interesting for me to read your book because you describe how the passion and the dedication that you had and that the scientists around you had really equaled the dedication that was there during World War II, during the Manhattan Project. And so there was that Cold War motivation. And there was also the challenge and the scientific curiosity of how you accomplish this thing. But then there was also something of which you were well aware, which is the really unimaginable or almost unimaginable destructive potential of these weapons. How did you think about that at the time, and what kind of conversations were there about that subject?
Yes, we thought about it, and the general notion was that if we developed large yield thermonuclear weapons, that they would be displayed by exploding them on an island or something and making it disappear, that they wouldn't be used militarily. When it came time to make that decision, the president had died, Roosevelt. Harry Truman had assumed the office. He knew nothing about what was going on. He got briefed, but he didn't fully understand it. The decisions were in the hands of the military, and the military at that time was the Department of the Army, actually, or whatever they call it. There was no Department of Defense. There was an Air Force, and there was an Army, and there was a Navy. At any rate, this project was in the hands of Henry Stimson, as I recall, and he made the decision to use the bomb against civilian targets, and that led to the destruction of Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And this was all rather unexpected, actually, but we were a little bit astonished when that happened, because we'd been led to believe otherwise, that it would be shown and that just displaying it would solve the problem. But he felt it had to be used.
And then when you were working on the thermonuclear bomb, that was far, far greater, a potential for killing people and for destroying huge areas.
Yes, it was. And if you're running a government and something comes along which is extremely powerful and can be decisive in any confrontation, then it's going to be developed. It's just, you just know it's going to happen. And so it was left to the military, and we hoped that it would remain controlled. And if you look back at the history of that, just knowing how destructive it would be and how horrible it would be to use it, It never has been used. And these very large yield weapons have been demonstrated, but there's no real military use for them, except to wipe out entire cities, and that's not a very logical objective.
You were there for one of the tests in the Pacific.
Yes.
What was that like?
Well, the first big one was the Mike test, which was cryogenic. That is, it was liquid deuterium. And it wasn't clear what the yield was going to be. We were betting on it, and were aboard the USS Estes, which was the laboratory ship headquarters of the test groups. And the yield was at the upper limit of every estimate. It was enormous. It was staggering. And I think most of us were just astonished when it was tested.
You write briefly in your memoir, we're talking to Dr. George Cowan, and his memoir is called Manhattan Project to the Santa Fe Institute, about the illusion of power and how politically the illusion is sometimes more important than the reality of power.
I think if you read history, that most military leaders have fostered the illusion, and if they are successful, they don't use their military in battles. They use them in pomp and circumstance and persuade the other guy. It's a little bit like the Wizard of Oz. You're behind a curtain and you rattle and shake and hope that nobody pulls the curtain down.
Now, in 1961, you began working on in a group that was looking for scientific applications for nuclear explosions. Were there any applications found?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Fission weapons are enormous sources of neutrons. And it's possible, by time of flight, to sort out these neutrons and energy so that the fast ones arrive at a target down a tube, an evacuated tube first, and the slow ones arrive last. And so doing time of flight neutron spectroscopy became a brand new field. If you had weapons available, we started in the United States, and other nations that were testing weapons did the same thing. They adopted our techniques, France in particular. So there is a whole field of time-of-flight neutron spectroscopy using weapons that was different than anything that had happened in science before, and quite valuable in discovering things about nuclear structure that hadn't been possible before.
Another thing that you looked at was the disposal of nuclear waste, and that is, to this day, a problem and controversy. What are your thoughts on the best disposal of nuclear waste?
Well, you can see what's happening. They talk a lot about it, and in fact, Yucca Mountain was constructed, and they spent I don't know how many billions of dollars on it, but it's never been used. None of these techniques have been used. Nuclear wastes are still stored at the surface, being guarded, and they probably will continue to be. There'll be a priesthood that watches over them, which is the military, generally, and they'll continue to be stored at the surface in spite of the fact that there's been so much attention paid to where they're eventually going to be stored. That probably is unlikely to happen. It's been storing at the surface has been going on for 40 years. It works very well, and it will probably continue.
Do you think that's safer than underground storage?
Yes, I do. If it starts to leak, you're there. If you store it underground, you have to go back in. It's a problem that once they think about it, I think most people who are responsible for this would prefer to store it at the surface and watch it. But when they talk to the public in general, there seems to be some magic about assuring them that it's going to be stored underground where you can't see it. So they seem to play that theme back to the public. At the same time, they're storing everything at the surface, and I think that'll continue.
You were a member of the White House Science Council under President Ronald Reagan in 1982, and there, once again, you encountered that gap between science and politics, and one of the issues was the so-called Star Wars Missile Defense Shield. What did you think of that program at the time?
Not very much. As you know, it never happened. The notion that it might was one they like to emphasize and talk about, because if you're going to attack the other guy and they really have an effective defense against you, you're going to lose. I mean, there's no point to doing it. So just the notion that you might, and that you might have an effective Star Wars defense, was a peacekeeping device. I was in favor of it, although I didn't necessarily think it was going to work. But again, it was one of these things where the illusion is more important than the reality.
Did anyone really buy the illusion?
I don't know. The people who make these decisions are not scientists, and so I don't know whether they were convinced by the illusion, but they were certainly impressed by it.
What do you think is both the role and the threat of nuclear weapons today?
It turns out that the role of nuclear weapons in the hands of responsible national powers has been constructive. It hasn't led to any war. The threat is that as it falls into the hands of the possibility and the actuality of us being possessed by small groups of terrorists is really frightening. And I'm surprised that New York hasn't disappeared by now because of terrorists. So I'm still deeply concerned about the possibility of nuclear weapons falling into the hands of small groups of terrorists.
What do you think is the most effective and useful role for scientists in politics? You had suggested in your book that there was this idea of a cabinet-level Department of Science and Technology. Scientific voices are so important, especially in issues like climate change and pollution and the state of the oceans and so on. How can that be effectively used and employed in politics, do you think?
Well, at the cabinet level, I don't really know. And the reason is there's no constituency for establishing a Department of Science. The scientists don't want it. They don't want to spend their time in Washington. The non-scientists don't want it. They don't want to see another power group spring up, which might, in fact, start winning arguments. And so there's no constituency for a Department of Science. Other countries, if you look at them, have established science at the department level, but it's never been terribly effective. If you look at the UK, for example, they do have a voice for science at the government level. I'm trying to think. But in any case, it's never been a policy-making group, and it shouldn't be. The demands of policy on policy-making groups are always so political that regardless of the technical content, the decisions tend to be made based on political considerations, and scientists would be very poor policymakers if they had to do that.
Although they know more about the subjects at hand than the policymakers, and their input, I mean, looking at it from the outside, really should be taken into much greater consideration than it is.
Well, I suppose that as a scientist I'd agree with you, but when I look at the things that politicians consider, there are those who have to be put back into office by Democratic vote. So I understand their inability to put through policy decisions. At the centers of governments which operate like the USSR, for example, I mean, which don't operate on the basis of a majority vote, but policy making by policymakers at the top level, I see them less subject to a popular will, But in spite of that, so far they've behaved rationally. And this is particularly true of Russia. Their decisions seem to be very rational. In fact, I've seen them act more rationally than our people in Washington. And as a matter of fact, in the late 40s, there was talk of going to war and settling it with nuclear weapons. But it was in Washington, not in Russia.
We're talking to George Cowan. His memoir is called Manhattan Project to the Santa Fe Institute. Now, you were one of the founders of the Santa Fe Institute. Let's talk about that. And you were its first president. What was the process by which you came to see the need for interdisciplinary scientific research?
I had run a division in the Los Alamos that was funded primarily by military needs, where we tested weapons that were going into the stockpile. I felt that it was a unique opportunity to tax the military for basic research. And when we ran a department that measured the results of military tests and development, we, in effect, had a 30% overhead, which paid for a great deal of autonomous research. And they were aware of this and thought this was fine. It was, from their point of view, a relatively small markup. But from our point of view, 30% was many millions of dollars, and it was a large research budget. And that's the part that I think in the end was most constructive of what we were doing. We did a lot of good research, I think, good research.
Now, are you talking about Los Alamos?
Well, there was Los Alamos and Livermore. We worked fairly closely together, actually, on research. And so I would say principally Los Alamos and Livermore.
And then what led you to found the Santa Fe Institute?
I wanted, I thought initially in founding the Santa Fe Institute that we would get scientists involved in natural science, who were the people I worked with, and health science, biology, involved in research that was funded with money from these other sources. We went more and more in that the natural scientists did come in, but more and more it was the people who were already in sociology and human sciences, the humanities even, that came to the Institute. And so, although I thought it was going to represent a vehicle for natural scientists to get involved in social science, it turned out the sociologists came in and kind of took over. So most of the people involved there now came out of the humanities and social science.
Well, one thing I found fascinating was that you noticed that the people looking at, for example, human behavior and the people looking at human brain function weren't talking to each other.
No, they don't. Brain scientists are not interested in the external manifestations, and the people who look at external manifestations, behavior, don't study the brain, and they're obviously related. It's not clear how, by the way. It's not obvious that certain neural patterns represent particular kinds of behavior, but more and more they're relating. The way actually to study this problem is happening to a greater extent now than before, and that is to study the early development of children. And what you need is data that represents their neuronal activity. And you can't do this just for research purposes. So you have children that injure themselves, they fall out of chairs or something, and then you have to measure brain activity, or rather you have to measure something about the baby, an x-ray or something like that. And so when you're doing that, you can at the same time measure neuronal activity, and you can relate it to behavior if you study their behavior. So there is a growing body of data in which little children with developing brains get studied for both the regional neuronal activity, where the brain is developing, and the types of behavior. So, for example, if you see a lot of activity in a prefrontal cortex, it usually means the baby is being confronted with a problem that needs to be solved and there's no ready solution. So they have to put things together and use logic, which is what happens in the prefrontal cortex. Well, this is all a new kind of research doing that kind of thing.
And demonstrates what you said earlier, which is that babies are little scientists.
Yes, indeed. If you look at neuronal activity, when a baby is born, there's a certain level of neuronal activity in the brain, most of it in the rear of the brain, and it proceeds from the rear to the front till it reaches the prefrontal cortex, probably the end of a year or so of age. And it's interesting to watch the brain wire itself up and to observe what the baby is doing as a result. The ability to do this has never existed before.
When you look at your work at the Santa Fe Institute and what the Institute has done since you were there, what do you think are the most important and interesting projects that they've taken on?
I hesitate to answer the question because the things that each of these scientists do is important. My own prejudice is that the most important thing that can come out of the Santa Fe Institute is a greater understanding of the forces, factors that shape human behavior. And we know that humans behave in a variety of ways. They aggregate in a variety of ways. First of all, as individuals, and then in aggregates that go range from the family to the church to the place of work and all kinds of clubs and organizations that get involved, become activists in politics. So they've done that, but studying human behavior, which is psychology, has really had an opportunity to look at the way the kinds of people that we have at the Institute shape their own behavior. That is, if you're talking about people who innovate, there's a difference between average neuronal behavior and the neuronal behavior of people who are innovating, writing original books, or doing art, or people that you think of as leaders of the intellectual and artistic community. And here we have a chance to look at what these leaders are actually responding to in terms of regional neuronal activity. And so I think we're learning a lot about where the ideas that are expressed by these people are shaped and within the brain, what parts of the brain contribute. By the way, it's frequently not a single region. You have to look at the whole brain to observe the sources of a particular pattern of behavior. There may be some particularly important region in the brain, but it's never a single, almost never a single region.
Yeah, my understanding is that what have become sort of cliches now about right and left brain are vastly oversimplified.
I've never paid much attention to right and left brain. It's interesting, but I think it's been speculative. And I agree with you, it tends to be oversimplified, or I would say too speculative. The data are not that strong.
Talk with us for a moment about the importance of basic scientific research.
Basic scientific research is not a popular topic for funding. The people who dispense money in industry and government generally have a mission in mind, and they want to know what the product will be and when the delivery date will be and so forth, whereas basic research doesn't have a mission in mind except to study things that are not well understood, and the objectives frequently are determined by individuals, by their interests and their perseverance. So they're rather two different things, the mission-oriented and the basic research. And the Santa Fe Institute, recognizing that, has made a special point of funding individual interests and the basic research parts without dictating what they're going to be. We have ideas about the subject matter, like human behavior, but not the particular way that the researcher is going to go about studying that subject.
You compared it to an investor having some high-risk investments in their portfolio, and it's important to do that because some of them always eventually will pay off.
Yes, and that's important to a director of research. To an individual scientist, it's a terrible gamble, because if they try to spread their money across various topics, it won't work. The research director can do that because he's hiring 100 people. But an individual has to dedicate himself to something, and he can't be a dilettante. So that's two different things. When I talked about the importance of doing this, I was thinking more of research direction, and the individual scientist will pursue what it is that most motivates him or her, and the director has to get the right spectrum of people and objectives.
When you look at some of the examples of basic research that has been done that has turned out to be very important in the long run, what are some examples of that?
Well, one of the people that I knew and admired as I was maturing in science, becoming more influential, was Glenn Seaborg at Berkeley at the University of California, who decided that he was going to explore the possibility of new elements in the periodic table going beyond uranium. And he has extended the periodic table almost by himself with his research people at Berkeley by over a dozen elements, and discovered how the chemistry of these things goes as you get heavier and heavier. And it's relevant to what's happening in possible fields of research and cosmology. The implosion of stars and the production of supernovae results in enormous neutron fluxes, and then these products spread out into the galaxies. We're prepared if any supernova occurs near enough in our planetary system, for example. It's going to be a very interesting field of research, because we will know the chemistry of the products that were made, which are decaying so rapidly that you only have a limited amount of time to find them. And therefore, it's got to be close in, fairly close in, and within the galaxy to find these products.
You are 90 years old. You've had a long and extremely productive life in science. When you look at your life and having written this memoir, what are the parts of your life and your activities that you are most proud of?
I think I've helped do something quite original when we started the Santa Fe Institute. I'm told by the people who come there that there's nothing else like it. And I'm not sure that knowing what we do means there will be something else like it. Because you may write down what we did, but in the end it's putting something like that together is a matter of taste, and taste is black magic. You can write it all down, describe it in a book, somebody will go do it, but it'll be different, because tastes are individual, and if you're going to put together a group of 100 people, you can be quite sure that if somebody else would try to put together 100 people in a Santa Fe Institute prime, the result would be different.
Well, Dr. Cowan, I want to thank you for your time and for being with us here on KSFR.
Thank you for having me.
And that was George Cowan, distinguished scientist, founding president of the Santa Fe Institute, very much beloved and missed by generations of scientists who came after him. Once again, he died on the 20th of April this year. I'm very happy now to welcome back to the program Janice Quinn. She is Executive Director of CASA. CASA stands for Court-Appointed Special Advocates here in New Mexico, in what, the First Judicial District of New Mexico?
Yes, that's the Santa Fe, Los Alamos, and Rio Rubio County area.
Okay, well, it's great to... It's been years since you've been
here.
I
know, nice to see you again.
It's nice to see you again, and you are actually retiring from having done this for quite a long time.
I am. I began with CASA in September of 2003 and became the executive director in May of 2005. So my R day is June 1st.
Okay.
And
coming right up.
Coming right up, yes.
So let's talk about CASA for a moment and what it does. You basically represent children in the foster care system.
Right. Our mission is to train community volunteers to advocate for kids who have been abused or neglected, and the state has decided they're no longer able to stay at home safely, so they remove them from their parents and put them in foster care. And then the parents have to go through a court process to prove that they can actually provide a safe home for the kids before they can get them back.
And so in this process, children, I mean, anybody would be vulnerable in that kind of a court process, including parents, but children are the most vulnerable, and they don't always have an advocate.
Right. They don't always have an advocate. Although, in our program here, I'm really proud to say that we've been able to serve 100% of the kids coming into the system in our district for several years now.
That's amazing.
That wasn't always the case.
So what are some of the kinds of circumstances that these kids find themselves in? I mean, are we talking about everything from infancy to 17 and a half years old?
0 to 18. If a child is born with drugs in their system, then the state removes the child immediately from the hospital, and they enter the foster care system.
Do they drug test infants?
They do.
They take their blood when they're born?
They do.
Good heavens.
Yeah. And it's probably a really good thing. I mean, I can go both ways on that, but I think it's really a good thing, because if you don't know that the child has got methadone or cocaine in its system and is having breathing problems, I mean, it's part of the health check of the newborn.
Right, right.
So then they can get the treatment that they need immediately, and they have a good chance of coming out of it, you know, of being a healthy infant after that. But the reason that kids get removed can be anything from neglect, which is the most, probably like 70%, and that can be medical neglect, emotional neglect, physical neglect, you know, not enough food in the house, not getting the kiddo to school, kids running around at 3 o'clock in the morning, and it's in January, and mom's passed out on the couch, physical abuse, sexual abuse, which is a small percentage. But parents find themselves in situations where they cannot take care of or will not take care of their children properly.
And what does that usually do to them? How much of it is substance abuse? How much of it is tremendous overwork? I mean, what's going on?
It's a lot of substance abuse, poverty. You know, the economics of the situation right now are not good and haven't been for several years, and that impacts everybody. Sometimes it's multi-generational drug abuse. It can be a lot of factors. There's mental illness involved, a lot of different factors, and there's a lot of single moms. So there's a
right.
lot of single parent homes that these kids come from.
So when you have kids who are then taken out of those homes and put in a foster system, it's also anybody's guess how well off they'll be there.
Well, the foster system goes, the foster homes and the parents who are stepping forward to do that work, in my mind, are angels. They go through quite a training process and a vetting process. But as good as they can be, it's still traumatic on the kids, because sometimes siblings can't stay together. We've got a case right now where there are 3 siblings in one home, 2 in another, and a 6th in a third home. They move schools, so they lose school credits. They maybe have to leave pets behind. They leave friends behind. So even if they were going to a perfect place, it's still traumatic for them.
And so you must, I'm sure there are all kinds of studies about the vulnerabilities of those kids in terms of their school grades, their high school graduation, and the outcomes after they turn 18.
Yes, and they're bleak. They're really bleak. Within 2 years, 50% of those kids will probably have been arrested. There's a lot of unwanted pregnancies, parents being parents before they're 20 years old after they age out of the system. Lots of them couch surf. They don't have a big support system. Aging out at 18 is really traumatic for kids, the ones who don't have a home to go back to.
And then those children of teenagers might end up in the system 10 years later or 5 years later.
They do. They do. We've seen third generations in the 9 years I've been with CASA.
Good heavens.
I know. That's the heartbreaker. That's where you want to just sit back and figure out, where can we stop this cycle?
Yeah. You know? What have you figured out?
We haven't. I think education, making the public aware, community aware. You know, it takes one person in a child's life to really turn that child's life around. So if people understand that they can step forward in a volunteer manner, no matter whether it's Big Brothers, Big Sisters, working with CASA, in a church group, whatever it is, if they can be there for a child who's in need, they can make that child's life better.
And that it's sort of a recurring theme. I keep coming up on this in my radio work and off the air as well, is that it's relationships that make the world go round, right, more than money, more than infrastructure, more than anything. I mean, that amount of love and connection that is created between two people changes lives.
It does. And, you know, kids in the foster care system, they may go through two or three homes in a year. We have one young girl, she's a young woman now. She's 21 years old. She was in 12 different foster homes. I don't know how many schools. You know, that kind of inconsistency makes the rest of your life look very unstable, and you lose a lot of trust. So if you can have one consistent adult in that child's life, even though they may change schools and foster homes and social workers, that gives them that kind of homing point. You know, there's somebody there for them all the time throughout that time period, which is really important.
And CASA, of course, is always looking for volunteers.
Always, I would say always, except that the fact that we are serving all the kids in our district right now means that we have CASAs waiting for kids rather than the other way around.
Is that right?
And that's due to several different factors. Children, Youth, and Families Department is really putting a lot of energy into in-home services, which means they're trying not to remove the kids from their home. They're trying to help the parents deal with their problems because they know how traumatic it is for the kids to be taken from their homes. So by the time they do come into the system, and there's less of them right now than there used to be, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, but by the time they do get removed from their homes after everything else has been tried, they're really pretty severely hurt.
We're talking to Janice Quinn, Executive Director of Court-Appointed Special Advocates. And you, how did you get into this work?
I don't know, just luck. Actually, it was my husband. He came home one day and he said, I'm going to volunteer to advocate for abused children. And I went, okay, you look like my husband, but this is something new for you. And it was the first time I had heard about CASA, which is crazy because CASA was started in 1977 in Seattle. And today there are over 10,000 programs and 70,000 volunteers. So with him taking his first case and me learning all about it, I just was enthralled. I was just amazed at the impact it had on kids' lives. And a position came available, and I applied for it. And a year and a half later, I was the executive director. So,
and so you moved into nonprofit work. Of course, there are so many nonprofits here in Santa Fe.
Right. Yeah, I came from a technology background, business development, sales, marketing training, and knew that I wanted to do something that, you know, made a lasting impact, which I feel very fortunate to have found CASA to be able to do that. But it was quite a difference coming from the a business world into the nonprofit world.
What are some of the differences?
Well, you can, and I'm just going to say this broadly, you can be very successful in your business and not have a passion for it. It can involve your head and not your heart. I don't think you can do nonprofit work without it involving your heart first. But it's also a business, so you have to have a business head to be able to run a good nonprofit organization.
Right.
You know, you have to stay afloat. You have to run it just like a business. But the passion and the heart and the belief that you're making a difference for the future is what you need every night to be able to sleep, especially when you're dealing with abused children.
I can't even imagine it. I mean, it must be in some ways so depressing and demoralizing at certain times.
It is. It is. And, you know, there's several tricks. Trauma stewardship is one of them, learning how to take care of yourself. But then just reminding yourself that every little thing that you do really does make an impact on a child. Children don't forget. They don't forget kindnesses, they don't forget hurts. But if you're the one giving the kindness and you're there for that child and you don't give up and you show up, then you know you're making a difference. And the national studies show that kids with in the foster system that have a CASA by their side spend half the time in foster care as the other kids do. They're 50% more assured of not coming back into the system, not bouncing back in again. And they get better services because the CASA is concentrating on one or two kids, and so they know their needs, education, emotional, medical, fun stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So they get to advocate for that.
Big Brothers Big Sisters is a program we've had on the air many times over the years, and basically a big takes time out of their week to spend some time with a little brother or sister. What about the CASA relationship? Do they get to spend just, you know, quality time together?
It's quality time, but it's not like a big brother, big sister situation. You're a court advocate appointed by a judge, sworn into an oath of confidentiality. You make written court reports with recommendations, you know, for what you think should happen for in the best interest of this child. You go to provider meetings. You meet with the social workers. You stay on top of the case and make sure that what's supposed to be done for the child is being done for it. So it carries a big responsibility. It's also not a thing where you take the kiddo over to your house and it's a weekend sleepover. Are you going to, you know, go out to eat someplace? It's a much different relationship.
Do you have sometimes a situation where a volunteer would like to become more of a mother or father figure or big brother kind of big sister relationship, but
sure,
they're not allowed to by the boundaries of their contract, so to speak?
All the time. And, you know, those types of tight relationships I totally support, as long as they're within the boundaries of what CASA's guidelines are. And when the court case is over, so many of our volunteers stay in touch with the families, whether it be the original biological family or the adoptive family, and the kids, because the kids and the families want them in their lives. So they're unofficial at that point, but they have become a member of that child's circle.
Janice Quinn, so having done this, now being at a place where you're about to retire and having perhaps some wisdom to share with us, what would you like to... What have you learned in your position at CASA, being executive director?
One of the biggest things I've learned is that Santa Fe's got 900 nonprofits, right? That's the bad side and that's the good side. Everybody's competing for funding. You know, it's tough out there. But there are so many incredible executive directors and board members and staff members that are willing to sit down and brainstorm ideas and figure out how to collaborate to get the solutions that we can all see, but we can't reach by ourselves.
Right.
So CASA's done a lot of collaborating with public and private, galleries, business owners, children, youth, and families, other nonprofits, to see a need and to make it happen for the kids. And I think Santa Fe Community Foundation in offering executive director circles and peer networking is really instrumental in bringing us all together, because when we come together, we fire off of each other.
Yeah.
And things happen. It's really great.
Do you think there's redundancy in the nonprofit world, people serving the same, not markets, but constituencies?
I think there is. I think everybody does something just a little bit different, but there is some overlap. And I have this dream of this kind of timeline where a 0 to 18 or a 0 to 21 is the age, and then you would see every nonprofit in town, where they fit, which age group, and which type of services they give. So we could all look at it and go, oh, look at that. We don't have anything for the 5 to 7-year-olds in this service.
Oh, interesting.
Arena. But we all do a little bit of the same thing, although I have to say CASA is unique because nobody else is even allowed in the courtroom. We're the only
right.
court-appointed nonprofit allowed to have access to these kids.
So what are you going to do when you retire?
I'm going to not be a neglectful orchard owner and vineyard owner, and I'm going to prune my grapes, and I'm going to make quilts for foster kids, and I'm going to see my grandson, and I'm planning my dad's 90th birthday in Texas in July.
Wow.
I'm going to rest a little bit.
Yeah, well, I'm sure you will be very much missed, but I guess CASA will also be hiring a new executive director soon, and we hope to get that person on the air. Maybe later this year or next year.
I think that would be great. Yeah, there's some really wonderful candidates, and CASA is going to be in great hands, and I'm looking forward to watching them grow and prosper, and I just hope that that everybody who's supported CASA in the past continues to do so.
Janice Quinn is the executive director of CASA, court-appointed special advocates. They're on the web at casafirst.org. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte.